Good morning. It's Tuesday, the 5th of May, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and flying staff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Most, except a few sharks, lose on prediction markets. U.S., Iran step up fighting in Strait standoff. Morgan Stanley faces inquiry for junior team in Hungary. Our first headline is by Neil Mehta, Catherine Long, and Caitlin Ostroff. Most, except a few sharks, lose on prediction markets. John Peterson, 33, couldn't work. The former Outback Steakhouse line cook was recovering from a car crash and low on money. Kalshi, the prediction market, promised a quick way to fix that. He took out a variable interest loan and started betting. At first, it worked. Peterson turned about $2,000 into close to $8,000 by betting on daily snowfall totals in Detroit, where he lives. He parlayed that into $41,000 by trading on sports using a strategy he developed with the help of AI, according to a Wall Street Journal review of his account records. Then he placed an audacious bet, all $41,000, that a celebrity would say a particular word on TV. He lost it all. Peterson isn't alone in walking away empty-handed from the bet on anything markets, which cover sports, celebrities, news, and more. Kalshi and its competitor, Polymarket, advertise themselves as life-changing tools for regular people, implying everyone has a fair chance to score. I was about to be unable to pay my rent, but I got 2 years of rent through Kalshi's predictions, gushed one woman in a Kalshi ad on TikTok. But for most users, the reality is nothing like that. Instead, casual traders are bleeding cash while a small number of sophisticated pros, including trading firms with access to vast streams of data, eat their lunch, according to a journal analysis of platform data and interviews with traders. On Polymarket, the journal found 67% of profits go to just 0.1% of accounts. That means less than 2,000 accounts netted a total of nearly $500 million. The journal analyzed 1.6 million Polymarket accounts that have traded since November 2022. There are at least 2.3 million accounts on the site. On Kalshi, too, losers vastly outnumber winners. Spokeswoman Elizabeth Diana said, "There are 2.9 unprofitable users for each profitable one based on data from the past month." She said the number is subject to change as the exchange grows. The company doesn't make public comprehensive data on users' profits and doesn't share its total number of users. Total trading volume on both platforms has rocketed to $24.2 billion in April, up from $1.8 billion a year earlier, according to analytics firm The Block. Proponents say the markets don't count as gambling and that they harness the wisdom of crowds to accurately predict events. Federal Reserve research shows Kalshi is an effective tool to forecast economic trends. Traders have been shelling out for access to big data streams from third-party providers to have a leg up. Computers use the data and algorithms to predict price movements and manage risk faster than any human. The pros also make use of their scale to make frequent strategic trades, sometimes tens of thousands a day, and book profits on incremental moves with a measure of attention and discipline rarely seen in recreational users. Casual traders have no chance systematically, said Michael Boss, a former professional poker player and statistician by training. On Kalshi, Boss places 60 trades a minute, modifies his bids, and asks 30 times a second. Diana said that many financial markets exhibit similar patterns of wealth concentration, and that more users make money on Kalshi than by day trading or on traditional sports books. She said Kalshi no longer runs the pay my rent ad. A spokeswoman for Polymarket declined to comment on the journal's analysis. Polymarket has a data partnership with Dow Jones, the publisher of the journal. The journal used only publicly available data for this analysis. In the case of Peterson, the out-of-work cook who lost his entire steak, he'd fallen for a category rife with sucker bets, mention markets. Professional traders say they don't touch those bets because they're unpredictable and even millions of dollars in data can't give them a reliable edge. The mention market bets, where users wager on what a person will say during a public appearance, routinely pay out less often than expected, according to the journal's analysis. Casual bettors are taking bigger risks than they realize, in part because of a phenomenon called long shot bias, in which bettors, driven by excitement, overvalue unlikely events. Monthly trading volume on Kalshi's mention markets, which dwarfs poly markets, has exploded since mid-2025, according to The Block. The bets are popular with the young users the sites are courting, including influencers who promote them on social media. Paying for data. For all types of bets, Polymarket and Kalshi make a simple pitch. Users can monetize what they already know to make a quick buck that has taken the world by storm. Yet more than 70% of Polymarket users lose money, the journal's analysis found. A working paper last month from researchers in France and Canada had similar findings. They found that the gains on prediction markets go almost entirely to sophisticated traders, while long-shot bets and unsophisticated traders take losses. The journal's analysis of Polymarket trading data indicates a typical user is down between $1 and $100, while the least successful 10% of Polymarket traders have lost an average of $4,000 each. Some make emotional decisions following their gut or based on information they've gleaned from public sources. A self-described problem gambler in Connecticut lost $2,000 in one day betting on the Super Bowl on Kalshi, all during the tense fourth quarter. A 31-year-old in Indiana who called the trading like a drug lost about $5,000 betting nearly daily on sports on Kalshi in the first months of the year. In contrast, the prediction markets have increasingly drawn firms staffed with dozens of employees that pay millions of dollars for specialty sports and finance data and run trading algorithms. They aim to win against the students, recreational gamblers, and other low-volume traders who make up most of the users on the sites. In traditional gambling, bookmakers set the odds, take in the bets, and pay off the winners. In prediction markets, there is no house, and users instead trade with other users. The platforms themselves take in fees on the trades, which can vary based on the price of the contracts a user buys, the type of market, and other factors. In a Soho office, a college dropout stares at a computer screen showing the flow of millions of dollars in bets on the price of Bitcoin. Samuel Wood Soloff left Princeton this year and collected a $500,000 check from Alliance Capital, an accelerator for crypto startups backed by prominent Silicon Valley investors. Wood Soloff moved with four friends to New York to trade prediction markets full-time, betting on sports, politics, and the future prices of cryptocurrencies. "Our only competition is market makers," he said in an interview, referring to other firms like his that continuously quote, buy, and sell positions. He declined to disclose his company's profits or losses, but says it has between $500,000 and $1 million deployed across Polymarket, Kalshi, and other smaller prediction markets. Boss, the former professional poker player, has made more than $668,000 on Kalshi, mostly on sports bets, according to his public profile on the platform, since he started taking trading seriously about 3 months ago. In addition to the speed of his trades, he's rigorous about how he prices his bids and asks. "The easiest money is going to be in sports," he said. "Sports has the attention of all the sick young men, I guess." By sick, he clarified, he meant gambling addicts. On Kalshi, he observed a large number of casual traders just bet yes on what they hope will happen. "That's not what you see in crypto or stock exchange where people are trading securities," he said. Jonathan Stahl Ryan is co-founder of another firm with around a dozen staff like him, all college students. The firm is among the top five traders by volume betting on crypto prices on Kalshi, and Stahl Ryan says it's turned $1,000 into seven-figure profits. The company pays more than $200,000 a year for live data feeds, AI coding agents and servers, and uses algorithms to execute live trades, tens of thousands a day. A lot of money. Most of these professional traders serve as market makers, Kelsey and Polymarket said. They rebate some market makers' fees and sometimes even pay them for providing liquidity. Quantitative trading firm Susquehanna International Group signed on Kelsey's first major institutional market maker in 2024. Susquehanna is believed to trade hundreds of millions of dollars through Kelsey each week, according to professional traders who monitor Kelsey's order book. It isn't clear how much money the firm is making because its profile is private. Susquehanna declined to comment. Jump Trading, a quantitative trading firm, is also active on Polymarket and Kelsey. In mid-April, Citadel's securities president, Jim Esposito, said at a Semaphore event that the firm was absolutely keeping an eye on developments in prediction markets. Some traders who buy high-risk options contracts are now flocking to the markets. All of sports betting, all of playing poker, all of options trading is making sure you're betting against someone you're smarter than, Susquehanna co-founder Jeff Yass said on a sports betting podcast in 2020. In the same podcast, he described his role supporting what would become a prediction markets as a mission from God. For one thing, Americans deserve to be able to bet on sports, even though some states bar the practice, he said, but also I expect to make a lot of money. Yass declined to comment through Susquehanna. Platforms design contract for users to bet on yes or no questions about future events. Contracts are usually set up to pay a dollar if a bet proves correct and zero if not. The contract's prices reflect traders' assessed probability of those events. If, for example, a contract tied to an event is trading for 41 cents, the prediction market would say there's a 41% chance of that happening. If you win, the contract you bought at 41 cents pays out at $1. If wrong, you lose your money. The price of a contract is constantly changing before it's settled, depending on the market forces of buyers and sellers. Traders profit from marginal changes in price, much like traders on Wall Street. Mention market bets hinge on a single question: will a public figure say a certain word? Traders on Kelsey bet more than $28 million on whether President Trump would say phrases such as cartel, Somali, or hockey during his State of the Union speech this year. In total, Kelsey users bet almost $181 million on mention markets in the month of February, according to the Block. The Journal's analysis, which looked at Kelsey data, indicates that mention markets pay out far less often than bettors expect based on their listed odds. The Journal analyzed over 35,000 completed mention markets on Kelsey and found that, on average, yes trades on mention markets priced at a 50% winning probability pay out around 40% of the time. Since the contract's prices are meant to match their odds, those bettors are overpaying. Trades on these markets, often exhibiting the long shot bias, routinely lose money, the Journal's analysis found. On average, mention market traders putting money on yes on the first price they see, a common pattern for retail traders, will lose 11% of the money they bet. Those returns are worse than most Vegas slot machines, according to research from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Diana, the Kelsey spokeswoman, acknowledged that mention markets face long shot bias, but said mention markets weren't representative of the platform's overall pricing and weren't a good candidate for this type of pricing analysis. She added that Kelsey's analysis showed mention markets were priced more accurately in the 4 hours prior to an event. Kelsey has encouraged mention market traders to live stream themselves trading during events, which two live streamers said was designed to boost engagement. Mention market streams on social media often go viral, Bank of America analysts wrote in an April report. And that's most, except a few sharks, lose on prediction markets. Our next headline, U.S.-Iran step up fighting in strait standoff. American forces sink attack boats in bid to open passage. Tehran hits tankers. This is by Jared Malson, Laura Seligman, and Costas Paris. The U.S. and Iran are teetering on the brink of a dangerous new phase of the war as both turn to military force to break a standoff in the Strait of Hormuz that has paralyzed shipping and imposed costs on both sides. Fighting flared for the first time in about a month on Monday, with the U.S. Navy trying to open the waterway and Iran targeting commercial ships to keep it closed. The U.S. said it used Apache helicopters to sink Iranian speedboats harassing traffic in the strait. Iran hit a critical oil port in the United Arab Emirates and several vessels around the strategic waterway. The return to a more openly violent phase of the war will test both sides. Each has reason to try to force an end to the current paralysis in the strait, but they also face substantial risks if the skirmishing escalates out of control. For Iran, greater damage to its economy and leadership, and for President Trump, deeper involvement in a war that's unpopular at home. Brian Clark, a former senior U.S. Navy official, now a senior fellow with the conservative Hudson Institute, said, "The new phase of the conflict is likely to play out at sea. That sets the stage for what could be a long and slow-burning contest, not as intense as the broad air campaign of the first 5 weeks of the war, but one with periodic violence that could escalate if either side miscalculates." The flare-up on Monday, the worst since Trump declared a ceasefire in early April, came hours after the president announced a new initiative to get ships that have been bottled up in the Persian Gulf out through the crucial waterway. Iran's constriction of the strait and a U.S. blockade of Iranian ports have deprived global markets of millions of barrels of oil, pushing up the price of gasoline and jet fuel and piling up pressure on Iran's economy. The increase in tensions began after the U.S. dispatched a pair of destroyers through the strait and separately helped two U.S. flagged ships steam out in an effort to break Iran's chokehold on the waterway. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps responded by launching cruise missiles and drones and by sending speedboats to attack ships. Admiral Brad Cooper, head of U.S. Central Command, which oversees the Middle East, said U.S. warships and aircraft responded by striking the ship's attackers, including sinking half a dozen Iranian fast attack craft. Sailors on merchant ships around the strait reported military jets and helicopters buzzing overhead and shared photos and videos of the U.S. forces. The president also said that if the process is interfered with, we will react forcefully, Cooper said, of the operation to open the strait. And over the last 12 hours, Iran has interfered. Iran fired cruise missiles at U.S. warships, too, Cooper said. Trump told Fox News that Iran would be blown off the face of the earth if it targeted U.S. ships. Iranian drones and other explosives slammed into a number of ships around the Gulf and hit the crucial UAE oil hub at Fujairah, where the country routes its oil exports around the constriction in the strait. The UAE, which has backed tougher action against Iran, repeatedly sounded alerts on Monday for the first time since early April, saying it was targeted by 15 missiles and a number of drones. Students were told they would go back to online schooling, and a number of flights were canceled amid the threats. Oman said a residential building housing company workers was hit. Offshore, merchant sailors saw a successful drone strike on the Marshall Islands flagged JV Innovation tanker. The captain of the tanker said it was hit at anchor on Monday, waiting to cross the strait when it was hit by a drone. In a recording from the ship's bridge reviewed by the Wall Street Journal, a captain is heard saying his ship was attacked and on fire, and asking other nearby ships to keep a safe distance. Another ship, the HMM Namu, was struck by an explosive late Monday, maritime security company Vanguard said. The UAE on Monday said two Iranian drones attacked a third tanker used by the state oil company ADNOC while it was transiting the strait. Iranian state media published a map on Monday of the Revolutionary Guard's area of control of the strait that encompassed the UAE port of Fujairah, the end of a pipeline the Gulf country uses to circumvent the blockage in the strait. Jack Kennedy, head of Middle East and North Africa country risk at S&P Global Market Intelligence, said Iran will continue to use asymmetric tools like drones and fast attack craft to attack ships or escalate against U.S. forces in the strait. The Revolutionary Guard, whose navy has choked off traffic in the strait, defied Trump's initiative, saying ships going through without its permission face serious risks. There has been no change in the management of the Strait of Hormuz, Sardar Mohibi, a spokesman for the Revolutionary Guard said, reported Tasnim, a news agency affiliated with the paramilitary group. Maritime movements, contrary to the principles announced by the IRGC Navy, will face serious risks. Violating vessels will be stopped by force. Ship owners said they were unwilling to risk a crossing, given the threat of attack from Iran and a lack of clarity around how the new U.S. operation to open the waterway would work. The developments have renewed uncertainty around the fate of the world's most important energy shipping lane, export route for about a fifth of the world's oil, which Iran closed after the U.S. and Israel launched their attack on the country. Millions of barrels of oil have been cut off and hundreds of ships are stranded in the Gulf with their crews. The U.S. has responded with a blockade of Iranian ports and by intercepting sanctioned ships in the shadow fleet that's moving Iranian oil. The price of Brent crude, the international benchmark, rose 5.8% to $114.44 a barrel, the third highest closing level of the year. U.S. warships sailed into the strait in early April for the first time since the war began. Military analysts had warned using them to open the strait would be difficult and dangerous. Even if some make it through with U.S. help, it would likely be far fewer than the roughly 130 ships a day that transited before the war, and it could take months to clear the hundreds of ships still stuck in the Gulf. Today it was war conditions, said Yorick Isik, a ship tracking analyst and the head of maritime consulting firm Bosphorus Observer. There is no ceasefire. That's U.S.-Iran step-up fighting in straight standoff. Our next article is by Alexander Saidi. Morgan Stanley faces inquiry for junior team in Hungary. A new cohort of young Morgan Stanley investment bankers showed up 2 years ago to their first day of work in a beige office building off the east bank of the Danube River in Budapest. The bank had recruited them from across Europe to work out of the Hungarian capital for a chance to be promoted to the big leagues in New York or London. Some of them worked into the morning hours several days a week to support teams in the U.S. six time zones behind them. For the bank, it was a way to move jobs offshore and hire cheaper labor to carry out the drudgery that well-paid young investment bankers typically do in their first years on the job, building financial models, formatting pitch decks, and occasionally helping execute big-ticket transactions. Now, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority in the U.S. has opened an inquiry about what kind of work the Budapest bankers were doing, how much contact they had with clients, and how they were supervised, people familiar with the matter said. The probe is at an early stage, the people said. A former employee had contacted the regulator as a whistleblower, the people said, alleging those in the program lacked the proper licenses that work would have required. The whistleblower said the bank violated rules meant to protect confidential information about clients and transactions from being mishandled. Morgan Stanley and FINRA declined to comment. The probe follows other tension inside the office, where some staff objected to working all hours of the night to support colleagues across the Atlantic Ocean while earning less, the people said. And Morgan Stanley has walked back the promise of transfers to the home offices, prompting several other analysts to quit. Morgan Stanley has expanded the group to around 40 analysts since launched in 2024, and four hires have been told they're moving to the mothership. Still, the growing pains show how investment banks are seeing mixed results as they look to cut costs and adapt how they hire young professionals out of college. The offshoring of back-office jobs to support bankers on Wall Street has been going on for years. J.P. Morgan has more than 1,500 people working in support roles in India, Argentina, and elsewhere for investment bankers. And Morgan Stanley already has teams helping to create PowerPoint presentations in places such as India and the Philippines. But those workers aren't typically allowed to carry out financial analysis and are viewed as support staff. In Budapest, Morgan Stanley took the idea one step further, moving front office jobs that typically go to graduates of top universities in cities such as London or New York. Much of the early career work for investment bankers can now be done from a computer anywhere in the world, giving Morgan Stanley a shot to catch up with competitors that appear to have more successfully moved their staff abroad. Other investment banks have experimented with staffing their jobs abroad with mixed results. Citigroup opened an office for junior bankers in southern Spain in 2022, paying them less but promising them an easy work-life balance. It closed last year. A rite of passage to a career on Wall Street working as a young investment banker has seen many of its vaunted perks scale back over the years. Banks are under pressure from investors to do more with less, and labor is often among their highest costs. Banks have also added artificial intelligence tools to make their junior teams leaner and less expensive. Morgan Stanley's program in Budapest started small in the summer of 2024 when a cohort of 7 young professionals from several European countries were hired as investment banking analysts. Hiring managers said they'd be able to locate to Morgan Stanley's prestigious investment bank in New York or London after around 2 years on the job, subject to good performance, people familiar with the program said. The first crop of analysts in the program took home around €1,500 a month, equivalent to $1,750, about one-third to one-half of what analysts make in the home offices, though the cost of living in Budapest is lower. The pay has since moved closer to €1,700 a month for most new hires. The young analysts in Budapest have similar roles and responsibilities to their peers in London and New York, working on pitch decks to help win the bank business and live deals to help clients raise capital or buy companies. They work the same hours as their counterparts, meaning that analysts supporting the New York office often toil between 1 p.m. and 7 a.m. local time, according to time-stamped messages reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. But unlike their colleagues in London and New York, the Budapest analysts work in a regulatory gray area. Regulators in both the U.S. and U.K. require that anyone engaged in investment banking pass exams and be licensed to work on sensitive multi-billion-dollar transactions, with limited exceptions for clerical work. The Hungarian investment bankers weren't required to take such exams, the people said. The bank made clear in a 2024 memo to staff that the Budapest analysts are not licensed to undertake any regulated activities, including direct contact with clients and any handling of know-your-customer processes. But the rules weren't properly enforced, the people said. For instance, they were regularly assigned tasks handling know-your-customer due diligence, the people said. One analyst received a scan of the passport of a chief executive of a prominent hedge fund manager as part of a client onboarding process for a transaction. In client pitch decks, the analysts were listed as employees on the New York and London team, sometimes designated with flags of the U.S. and U.K. More recently, another analyst traveled to meet a client based in Europe, people familiar with the matter said. Morgan Stanley put limits on hours worked for young employees after the death of a 35-year-old banker at Bank of America in 2024, reflecting long-standing concerns about how much pressure young employees on Wall Street face to be productive from their bosses. But the teams in Budapest and those in the home offices often didn't follow those guidelines, people familiar with the program said. The Budapest analysts would sometimes push back against their counterparts in the U.S. when asked to work past the 7 a.m. on non-urgent work, according to messages reviewed by the journal. In one message, around 6:30 a.m., an analyst asked if he could stop working on a pitch deck since it was already morning in Budapest. A more senior banker in the U.S. asked if he'd been given permission to sign off early, insisting there was a hard deadline and the work had to continue. The lower pay also stoked resentment. When the first 7 analysts were hired in 2024, Morgan Stanley's Employee Handbook for Hungarian Employees specified that as analysts they were eligible for overtime pay if they worked more than 40 hours, according to a copy of the handbook reviewed by the journal. Morgan Stanley later informed them that the handbook had been updated shortly before they started working. Their role as analysts had been reclassified to the same level as senior managers, meaning they were no longer eligible for overtime pay, those people said. Then in the fall of last year, team managers gathered the analysts and told them that relocation to New York or London wasn't a guarantee, and the minimum time they'd have to spend in Budapest had jumped from 2 years to three, the people said. If they made it to New York or London, they'd start over as an analyst at the bottom of the totem pole. Around 20% of the total analyst class quit soon after the announcement. That's Morgan Stanley faces inquiry for junior team in Hungary. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. You can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, such as the Wall Street Journal, either at a time of your choosing or just as it streams by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, and that's at sunsounds.org. Or you can download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, and that's available for your iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store or from the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. Well, let's turn now to the business and finance page of the Wall Street Journal. And we have these headlines: oil soars, stocks fall as war escalates. Robotaxi industry takes off across the U.S. And Cerebras plans IPO that could bring in $3.5 billion. That first headline, oil soars, stocks fall as war escalates. Investors fear that increasing energy costs will spur inflation, hurt profits. This is by Jack Pitcher. Investors were back on edge Monday, sending oil prices sharply higher and stocks lower after military tensions escalated in the Strait of Hormuz. Fighting in the Iran war flared for the first time in weeks as strikes on several ships and a crucial United Arab Emirates oil port tested a shaky ceasefire. Brent crude, the international oil benchmark, rose 5.8% to $114.44 a barrel, the third highest closing level of the year. The prospect that rising energy prices will fuel inflation drove stocks lower and bond yields higher, with the yield on the 10-year note hitting 4.445% from 4.377% on Friday, and its highest close since July. Wall Street's hopes for rate cuts later this year, once the consensus view, are fast slipping away. Traders in interest rate derivatives now see an almost 30% chance the Federal Reserve will raise rates by the end of the year, up from 9% on Friday. Rising yields are sapping risk appetites on Wall Street, said Jose Torres, senior economist at Interactive Brokers. Major indexes declined after the S&P 500 and NASDAQ Composite both closed at records Friday. The S&P 500 lost 0.4%, with every sector except energy closing lower. The NASDAQ slipped 0.2%, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1.1%, or around 557 points. Shares of Home Depot, Nike, Boeing, and Goldman Sachs all dropped at least 2%, weighing on the Blue Chip Index. United Parcel Service was the S&P's worst performer, dropping 10% after the Wall Street Journal reported that Amazon.com is opening up its global supply chain network to all businesses. President Trump posted Monday afternoon that Iran has taken some shots at unrelated nations, including a South Korean cargo ship. He added, "We've shot down seven small boats, or as they like to call them, fast boats. It's all they have left." Overseas, the stocks Europe 600 slipped 1%, weighed down by auto stocks after Trump said the U.S. will raise tariffs on automobiles from the European Union. South Korea's KOSPI rose 5.1% to a record. That's oil soars, stocks fall as war escalates. Next, Sean McLean writes, robotaxi industry takes off across the U.S. After nearly a decade-long cycle of hype, disappointment, then renewed hype, self-driving taxis are starting to roll onto streets in a rapidly growing number of cities across the U.S. Today, driverless vehicles from Waymo, Tesla, Zoox, and a small army of lesser-known companies are trundling the streets of California, Texas, and several other states. A boom in the 2010s saw the creation of dozens of hyped startups promising to eliminate car ownership. But the high cost of developing the technology, the technical challenges of navigating crowded streets autonomously, and the complex regulatory environment meant many went out of business. High-profile accidents also drew increased scrutiny upon the safety of driverless vehicles. Morgan Stanley estimates roughly half of the American population will have access to a robo-taxi service within the next 3 years. The number of autonomous rides being conducted in the U.S. is expected to rise rapidly from around 15 million in 2025 to about 36 million this year, according to Morgan Stanley estimates. By 2030, the figure is expected to hit nearly 750 million rides. Some companies are going it alone, while others are seeking deep-pocketed partners or planning to offer services through existing services such as Uber. Here are the current U.S. operations and expansion plans of some of the competitors in the robotaxi race. Waymo is the current leader in the robotaxi industry, operating more vehicles and more markets than its competitors. In some markets, Waymo's autonomous vehicles are starting to navigate freeways and airports. Most of Waymo's fleet are Jaguar EVs, although the company is testing its latest vehicle, an electric van called the OJ. In 2023, during the first month of offering paid rides in San Francisco, Waymo vehicles made 10,000 trips a week. In March, Waymo said its fleet of vehicles had made 500,000 trips a week. Tesla is one of the most closely watched among the robotaxi competitors. Chief Executive Elon Musk has made bold pronouncements about the ability of driverless vehicles to transform society and his company's fortunes by deploying millions of self-driving Teslas across the U.S. Robota XIs are central to Tesla's strategy to transform from a car maker to an AI and robotics company worth trillions of dollars. Tesla hasn't disclosed how many vehicles are in its robotaxi fleet, but Robotaxi Tracker, a crowdsourced robotaxi data company, found nearly 600 Tesla vehicles offering rides in the past 30 days. Currently, the company is only offering paid rides in Texas. Musk says the company is being cautious with the rollout of the service out of safety concerns. The Tesla chief said the company aims to expand to at least a dozen states this year. Zoox was founded in 2014, one of several self-driving startups founded around the same time. Amazon.com acquired the company in 2020 for around $1.2 billion after Zoox struggled to raise funds. Unlike Waymo and Tesla, Zoox isn't using conventional cars for its robotaxi service. The company's box-shaped vehicles have sliding doors and seats more reminiscent of subway trains than automobiles. They also have no steering wheels, so they need a special exemption from federal vehicle standards. Zoox is currently awaiting approval to offer paid rides. Since selling its self-driving arm in 2020, Uber has pivoted from trying to develop its own robotic cars to joining up with outside companies, sometimes by buying stakes in those companies or agreeing to purchase vehicles outright. The strategy marks a departure for a company that built itself on being an asset-light aggregator of private vehicles. Uber recently signed deals to buy tens of thousands of vehicles from EV makers Rivian and Lucid. Today, Uber has more than two dozen partnerships with car makers and other robo-taxi providers, including Waymo, Zoox, and smaller players such as Moya and Motional. Moya is the robo-taxi subsidiary of German carmaker Volkswagen, which was established in 2016 to fend off threats from tech upstarts that predicted an end to personal car ownership. The company's vehicles are based on the ID. Buzz electric van, which itself is inspired by one of the German company's most distinctive machines, the Volkswagen Bus. Moya has been testing vehicles and says it aims to launch services in Los Angeles through the Uber app and in Orlando, Florida through Beep in 2026. The company said it's targeting a fleet of around 100 vehicles by early next year. Motional is the robo-taxi arm of South Korea's Hyundai Motor Group. company's been testing autonomous vehicles in Las Vegas since 2021. That's robotaxi industry takes off across the U.S. Our next article, Cerebras plans IPO that could bring in $3.5 billion. This is by Nicholas Miller. Chip startup Cerebras Systems will offer 28 million shares in its planned initial public offering at a price of $115 to $125 a share. The IPO would raise $3.5 billion at the upper end of the pricing range. Cerebras will grant the underwriters of the offering a 30-day option to purchase as much as an additional 4.2 million shares. Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, Barclays, and UBS Investment Bank will act as lead book-running managers for the offering. Cerebras, a chip startup that makes processors customized for running advanced artificial intelligence models, filed paperwork last month to go public. The company had planned to go public last year, but canceled its plans in October. Cerebras is seeing surging demand for its processors as AI labs transition from training to running their models. Cerebras chips are better suited for inference workloads, the types of computations required to allow an AI model to respond to user queries, than the GPU chips the AI industry has relied upon for model training. In January, Cerebras struck a deal valued at upwards of $10 billion to supply 750 megawatts of computing power to OpenAI. Last month, Amazon Web Services signed a deal to use the company's chips for its data centers. And that's Cerebras plans IPO that could bring in $3.5 billion. Our next article, Berkshire Picks Next Insurance Chieftain, is by Crystal Herr. Berkshire Hathaway has selected Gen Re Chairman Charlie Shamich as the successor to longtime insurance mastermind Ajit Jain, aiming to ensure a smooth leadership transition at one of the conglomerate's most critical businesses, people familiar with the matter said. Shamich said will step in to run Berkshire's sprawling insurance arm when Jain decides to retire, the people said. Jain, a 74-year-old executive who Berkshire chairman Warren Buffett has said is irreplaceable, hasn't signaled when he'll step down. He's expected to remain in the role for the foreseeable future. Shamich is a familiar figure within the insurance world, even though many Berkshire shareholders might have had trouble picking him out of the crowds at the company's annual meeting in Omaha, Nebraska last weekend. He has decades of experience in the industry, spending time at American International Group and Germany's Munich Re Group before joining Berkshire's Gen Re in 2018. Berkshire has just gone through a succession at its helm with Greg Abel succeeding Buffett as chief executive in January. The next mystery for shareholders was who would succeed Jain. Jain said in 2024 that he delivered to Buffett and the Berkshire board a short list of candidates for his successor. When asked about Jain's future at Saturday's shareholder meeting, Abel said Berkshire had settled on a succession plan. Much like Buffett's handoff to Abel, the timing of Jain's transition to Shamich is uncertain. Abel's name first surfaced as the choice 4 years before Buffett unveiled in May 2025 his decision to step down at year-end. Earlier this year, Buffett told the Wall Street Journal that Jain was probably going to be at the company for as long as he can. Should Jain stay for years, people said, Berkshire could ultimately land on a different successor. Many Berkshire watchers, including Buffett himself, have long argued that getting Jain's replacement right was just as important as finding the right CEO, given the insurance arm's central role in what has set Berkshire apart from its peers and the complexities and risks that accompany the business. Profits from the insurance business have made billions of dollars for Berkshire, helping fuel the expansion of the conglomerate and its stock portfolio. Buffett has said that insurance is Berkshire's most important business, and Jain has been the brains behind it for four decades. Buffett has lavished praise on the executive for his preternatural ability to craft offbeat policies, including insuring Chicago's tallest building against terrorist attacks and Pepsi against having to award a $1 billion raffle prize. Today, Berkshire's insurance arm has a range of businesses, including GEICO, property and casualty workers' compensation, medical liability, and reinsurance. Replacing the architect of that business won't be easy. During the weekend shareholders gathering in Omaha, Shema was spotted wearing an event pass branded CEO Lunch that would give him access to a Friday event reserved for the chief executives of each of Berkshire's subsidiaries. When a fellow Berkshire executive asked him on a brief elevator ride why his pass looked different than the manager's lanyard he wore, Shema gave a noncommittal response. While some insurance industry insiders have raised Shamey as a potential Jane successor, many Berkshire shareholders were betting on one of insurance unit CEOs to emerge as the choice. Jen Rhee CEO Kara Rigel and Allegheny's Joe Brandon were two mentioned as candidates, as was Todd Combs, the money manager who led GEICO before decamping to J.P. Morgan Chase in December. Buffett has said that Berkshire's insurance arm will be different when Ajit is no longer leading it, but that it has a strong foundation for his successor to take over. "We won't find another Ajit," Buffett said at Berkshire's 2024 annual meeting. And that's Berkshire Picks next insurance chieftain. We'll turn now to an aluminum crisis roils auto industry. This is by Bob Tita. For Texas Ford dealer Sam Pack, the F-150 and Super Duty trucks aren't just important vehicles. He says they are the foundation of his business. That's why Pack, who owns four stores in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, is a little nervous right now. Pack's truck supply is limited because of a shortage of aluminum that's roiling the entire auto industry. He has about 42 days worth of F-150 inventory, down from the 60 days he normally maintains. "We'd love to have more," he said. Pack worries about having enough trucks for the busy summer season. "The real critical period is going to be the next 90 days, he said. "The trucks are in short supply because aluminum, the metal used to make their bodies, is in short supply and sharply more expensive than in years past. Aluminum has become a key commodity for automakers looking to boost the fuel economy and efficiency of their vehicles with a metal that's lighter than steel and doesn't sacrifice strength." The auto industry in North America consumed 3.7 million metric tons of aluminum last year, nearly 30% more than in 2020, according to the metals market consulting firm CRU. Lately, however, high aluminum prices from the Iran war, a 50% U.S. tariff, and a production outage by a major supplier have strained automakers. "The cost of metals, specifically aluminum, has been a big focus for us," R.J. Scharinge, chief executive of electric vehicle maker Rivian Automotive, said on a recent earnings call. "The U.S. cost of primary aluminum from smelters is nearly 90% higher than a year ago. The war in Iran is driving up prices by effectively choking off shipments from the Persian Gulf countries, which supply about one-fifth of the aluminum consumed in the U.S. The U.S. aluminum industry is also heavily dependent on imported primary aluminum, mostly from Canada, but automakers and other buyers pay the tariff no matter where the metal comes from. With the global aluminum price at about $3,500 a metric ton, the tariff and delivery-related charges raise the U.S. price to around $6,100 compared with $3,220 paid a year ago, according to S&P Global Energy. The pain is especially acute at Ford. The Dearborn, Michigan-based automaker switched the F-150, America's best-selling vehicle, to an aluminum exterior body from steel in 2014. At the time, Ford Motor and the other automakers faced ever stricter federal fuel economy regulations. Coupled with smaller, more efficient engines, the aluminum F-150 delivered between 5 and 29% better fuel economy than the previous model. In the process, Ford became the auto industry's biggest aluminum buyer. Decade later, that's become a liability for Ford, compounded by multiple fires last fall at its main aluminum supplier in upstate New York. Shutdowns at the plant, which is operated by Atlanta-based Novelis, hit Ford's bottom line hard, reducing adjusted profit last year by $2 billion. Ford executives said on an earnings call this past week that the company has doubled its expected commodity costs from $1 billion to $2 billion this year, largely because of rising aluminum costs. Ford sold about 160,000 F-Series trucks in the first quarter of this year, down from 190,000 the same period last year, according to Motor Intelligence. The company said it expects to build an additional 150,000 trucks this year over 2025's reduced volume to make up for the aluminum plant outage. Ford has a much larger exposure to aluminum costs than anybody else, said Sam Fiorani, vice president of consulting firm Auto Forecast Solutions. Ford said last week that it expects the aluminum rolling line at Oswego, New York plant to restart this month, although Novelis had earlier set a late June target. Whenever production resumes, it will be gradual and won't replenish supplies right away. If we have any hiccups, we have contingency plans, Ford's chief operating officer, Kumar Galhotra, told industry analysts last week. We have additional aluminum supply to ensure our plant production schedules aren't interrupted. Ford recently asked the Trump administration to waive the 50% tariff on imported aluminum until the Oswego plant returns to full service, according to people with knowledge of the conversations. So far, administration officials haven't budged. The head of the U.S.'s largest supplier of automotive steel suggested in April that the situation is causing automakers to rethink their dependence on aluminum. I've never seen so much momentum in substituting aluminum for steel, said Lourenco Goncalves, chief executive of steelmaker Cleveland-Cliffs. Even as automakers no longer face the strict fuel economy rules they did in the Biden years, others say there's no evidence of a widespread move back to steel. I don't believe you're going to see it, said Mark Millett, chief executive of Steel Dynamics, which also supplies the auto industry with aluminum. Millett said the cost of engineering and retooling the equipment that makes aluminum components to produce steel parts instead would be expensive and time-consuming. Analyst Fiorani agreed, especially in Ford's case. They built that vehicle around aluminum. It's going to be very difficult to change its body structure, he said. And that's an aluminum crisis roils auto industry. Our last item will be from the Heard on the Street section. In AI We Trust, Why Spending is So Buoyant. This is by Spencer Jacob. Don't bet against the American consumer. It's a maxim investors ignore at their peril. There have been, of course, times that the household spending slumped, but almost always later than when one would have guessed from reading the headlines. That resilience is on display again. Despite a war, rising gasoline prices and a 74-year low in consumer sentiment, registers kept ringing the past couple of months. The latest Commerce Department spending and inflation data is from March, but more recent private sector indicators look healthy, too. John Tomlinson, co-chief research officer at data firm M-Science, said last week that multiple sources his firm tracks pointed to decent trends well into April. This spending is happening alongside the slowest income growth in years, though. As a result, Americans' personal savings rate is down to a level not seen since inflationary 2022. The entire period during and after the COVID shock was volatile as we went from a panic to stimulus checks to an unsustainable splurge. For a cleaner comparison, the savings rate averaged 6.2% of income in the 10 years before the pandemic. It was just 3.6% in March. There are two explanations for why household spending has stayed so strong relative to wage income. One is lower tax withholdings plus bigger tax refunds, a mostly lower and middle-income household crutch that's now fading. Another, which mainly helps wealthier families, is stock market strength. The S&P 500 recovered its initial war losses in just 6 weeks and is now up 5% since the start of hostilities. That highlights a catch-22. Stocks are so buoyant in part because overall consumption has defied war gloom. It isn't just households. Businesses are doing their part to keep the economy above water, but that's K-shaped too. Spending on AI infrastructure was behind a sharp rise in business investment during the first quarter, the strongest in almost 3 years. Most other areas were weak. Investor calls last week from four AI hyperscalers didn't hint at any slowdown in their plans. A Wall Street Journal report last week that model developer OpenAI has failed to meet internal targets sent only a brief flutter through AI-related stocks. Most big tech companies have financial firepower to keep investing. Further hints that there isn't a pot of gold at the end of the AI rainbow could dent shareholder and lender confidence, though. The same AI investment thesis has encouraged well-off households to spend so much and save so little. Consumption has rarely depended this much on faith in one hot sector and vice versa. And that's In AI We Trust, Why Spending is So Buoyant. You've been listening to this Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal here on Sunsounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this Tuesday edition and remind you that you can listen to the Wall Street Journal anytime or as it streams by going to the Sunsounds of Arizona website. And that's available at sunsounds.org. Or you can download the Sunsounds of Arizona app. And that's available for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store or for your iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store. And you can listen to Sunsounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.